elevate your summer with Osea's best-selling body care set. It's everything you need for radiant summer skin on the go. Featuring travel sizes of Osea's clean, vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral skincare, like their best-selling Undaria Algae Body Oil. Right now, you can get the bestseller's body care set, a $78 value, 33% off. And use code SUMMER to save an additional 10%. That's an additional 10% off at oceamalibu.com, code SUMMER.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Lifetime's Robin Roberts Presents Mahalia. From executive producers Robin Roberts and Linda Berman comes the biopic of the legendary Mahalia Jackson. Grammy Award winner Danielle Brooks stars as the trailblazer whose music moved, inspired, and changed people's hearts. Critics have praised Brooks's transformative performance into the Queen of Gospel as thunderingly good. Directed by Kenny Leon and written by Bettina Jilloa and Todd Kreidler, this Lifetime original movie continues to inspire viewers and highlights the ongoing fight for social justice. Robin Roberts presents Mahalia for your Emmy consideration in all categories. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. My name is Dino Ray Ramos.
And I'm Amanda Nduka. And so for this episode, we have the David Oyelowo, the director of, he directed his first film, The Water Man, which is it's a movie about this little boy who basically, his mom is sick, and he basically goes on this just journey to find this mythical water man because he believes this water man has magical healing powers. So, and we compared it, David talks about how he sort of pulls from classic adventure, sci-fi.
Like Spielbergian kind of
right,
stuff.
He talked about the Goonies was a big inspiration for him. And obviously we know David from Selma. I mean, he's done a whole bunch of things since then, but
And he's super talented. And he also stars in the movie as well. Alongside Rosario Dawson. Shout out to her. I love kind of the fantasy and adventure of it all, and I just think David is pretty dope. I mean, he's really funny too. He called me out on a couple things during the episode, but that's okay because it's David Oyelowo, and it was all in good fun,
And the movie will be out. The movie's out now, and I believe I think it's going to be available.
I think it's going to be theatrical, and then it's going to be available on VOD after.
Yeah. And I know Netflix has the international rights, so for our international listeners, you can just
shout out to our internationals.
Shout out to our international listeners. you guys, David is great. I mean, I always feel when I say people are great, does it sound genuine? Because I'm I honestly really do think.
Yeah, you do. Okay, I think all of our guests are great. Because otherwise we wouldn't have them on.
But David is especially, and he's doing great things for us and representation and for the Nigerians out here in this business. Shout out to all the Nigerians that are doing great things in entertainment.
Yeah, we got a lot of Nigerians. We'll let you know who they are later, guys.
It's exciting, guys. It's really exciting. So without further ado, here is David.
I missed the BAFTAs yesterday, but I didn't even realize that there was a whole red carpet extravaganza. I mean, I saw Ye Jung Yun's acceptance speech, which I thought was amazing.
Yeah, I presented to her.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
You know, I she's right, by the way. I am proudly snobbish, but I'm just. It was just nice to have it called out on screen.
But there was something so endearing how she said it. It was just so
"Oh, you're right."
I know. Yeah, so matter of fact.
Can you know, like, when you have like these aunties that can pretty much say like whatever.
No.
Like,
he was like, basically an auntie. She was all, "You're all snobbish, but thank you."
Yeah, but can you imagine gifting someone a BAFTA and then they turn around and basically cuss you out? I mean,
just like, I feel like that's what my aunties would do.
Yeah. They're like, "Oh, well, you gave me this BAFTA, but it's kind of not shiny. You know, right? I don't know what y'all, this looks this like trash, but thanks."
Okay. Yeah, that was really cool. Oh, that's good that you guys got to be out and about and around people. I hope, you know, everybody was still safe and feeling comfortable, because I have a feeling we're about to move into that phase now of being back out, and I'm really anxious to see how that's gonna go.
The awkward phase of the pandemic.
Well, I'm on my third project during the pandemic now, and so I can give you a heads up. It's actually extraordinary how exhausting human interaction is. like I did a film recently in London where we had hundreds of extras, and we had to rehearse. And, you know, just that interaction with humanity after you've been in your house for a year, you know, people just needed to go home and have like a nap from just being around people. It's quite exhausting, you know.
Yeah, no, yeah. I feel that. But anyways, David, thank you so much for being here. I don't know if we forgot to thank you at the top of it, but welcome to Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast.
Thank you.
Very excited to have you. Might have my own personal reasons, but obviously, like, you've been and done some amazing things in your work, and we're here to talk about your first directorial feature, The Waterman. But before we get to that, so we like to get like people's backstories. I feel like everybody has a really amazing journey and a story to tell about how they ended up where they are in this business, in this crazy business. So for you, when did you realize that you wanted to be a performer?
It came a bit later for me than it does for some people who you know, a lot of people, it's when they were a kid, very young, and they watched movies. And, you know, because, you know, you and I, Amanda, share, you know, having Nigerian parents in terms of our heritage, you know, becoming an actor is just like not one of the top million professions.
Doctor, lawyer, engineer.
Doctor, lawyer, engineer.
It's the same for the Filipinos. It's the same thing.
It's an immigrant thing. It's an immigrant thing. And what you just said there, Amanda, that was exactly the three, you know, a lawyer, doctor, engineer. My parents had three sons, and I was the one who was gifted the thought of becoming a lawyer. And I thought that's what I was going to do, you know, but I should have known better, because I was more interested in the fact that Blair Underwood was acting a lawyer in the show LA Law than being an actual lawyer. You know, with you know, I did youth theater productions. I actually got a really great role at a youth theater at the National Theater in the UK. And I didn't, you know, we had lived in Nigeria. I was born in the UK, but we lived in Nigeria from the age of 6 for me till the age of 13. And then we moved back to the UK. And I was really quite a shy kid. I actually fell in love with my pastor's daughter, who didn't even know I existed. You know, I just sort of admired her from the back of the church as she worked the overhead projector. And then one day she invited me on what I thought was a date, but it was actually to go and join a youth theater at the National Theater. I didn't even know what the National Theater was. And so, you know, I kept going because I really liked her. And then I just started to fall in love with this notion of being an actor. And actually, even before then, what happened is there was one day, these three boys were being groomed to be the lead in this show, and all of them were late to the rehearsal. They were stuck on trains because there was a train strike. And the director said, you come up and just read in the lines. And I guess I just did the lines in the way I pictured I would do it. And the room went completely silent. I thought I'd completely bombed it. And then within a week, I was cast in the lead of this show. And so my very first role was on one of the stages at the National Theater. And I got these great reviews and I was only 15. And I thought, whoa, this is something I really like doing. I ended up taking theater in high school. And then I had a teacher who just really encouraged me and said, I think this is something you can do for a living. She helped me apply to drama school. My parents were still like really anti the idea of anything arts, but I got a scholarship to go to the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts. And even though my dad couldn't understand acting, he could understand scholarship. so that's what swung it. And I went to Lambda for 3 years, and then it sort of went from there.
Yeah. So wait, what was it? When was the changing point for you when it came to your parents? Like, when did they become excited about what you do?
About 3 years after leaving drama school, I was so blessed, so blessed to play Henry VI at the Royal Shakespeare Company. And my dad was the kind of person, if you give him a warm room with a comfy seat, and it's dark, within about a minute and a half, he will be asleep. So taking him to the theater was just always a disaster. And I remember him coming to my graduation show, and both my mom and dad wore their traditional Nigerian clothes, which was sparkling in the dark. And it was my graduation presentation. And I walk on stage and there are two people in very bright clothes leaning on each other asleep. Of course, those are my parents. And literally the theater lights are sort of catching on the clothes. So it's like everyone, you know, they are glowing in their slumber. So, you know, when I got Henry VI, it was Henry VI parts 1, 2, and 3. And on a Saturday, we would perform all three.
Oh, wow.
In the same day. We would start at 10:30 in the morning and then finish at 10:30 at night. And of course, I thought, well, this is going to be catastrophic for my dad. But I will say he sat through 12 hours of Shakespeare, was awake the whole time.
Wow.
And came up to me at the stage door afterwards and he said to me, I cannot believe they allowed a black man to play the King of England and it is my son.
Oh my God.
And that was the day beyond which he became my number one fan.
Oh,
that's such a good story.
You know,
you probably told that plenty of times.
Everything you were saying, I had it, the picture in my head. It is such a big deal when especially African, when they stay up through something.
Oh, yeah. That's a massive sacrifice.
So, oh my gosh, I love that story. So for you though, I mean, you grew up in, you sort of grew up in Nigeria and in London and everything. So how has your sort of your own identity and your upbringing influenced your career path so far, thus far?
It has enormously, in the sense that it was very, I feel very, very fortunate that for formative years of my life, I lived in a country and in a society where I wasn't a minority, because it did something to my perception of myself and what was possible for me. You know, when you live in countries where you're a minority, where racism is prevalent, where marginalization is prevalent, where not every opportunity on offer in that society is yours for the taking, whether literally or even psychologically, just in terms of your perspective, it really affects how you get out of bed every day, how you perceive where your glass ceiling is, what you can achieve. And because from the age of 6 to 13, I lived in a society where every opportunity on offer was mine for the taking, it was just something that got ingrained in me. And so even when we moved back to the UK, and then when I eventually moved to the US with my family, for some reason, I never went back to a minority mentality. It's what I call the Sidney Poitier syndrome. You know, I often look at Sidney Poitier and just think, how did he achieve what he achieved in that time he achieved it? I mean, even now what he achieved is tough to achieve. And I think it's because he also grew up in a society in a, you know, in the Caribbean where he was not a minority. And so he took that mindset into America and said, I know who I am, give me what is due to me. And if you don't, I'm gonna pursue it anyway. Mm-hmm. And that has been something that has sort of really stood me in good stead. Doesn't mean I haven't faced challenges, doesn't mean that there haven't been glass ceilings I've had to sort of try and bust my way through, but I've never let it influence how I perceive myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's just amazing about, you know, because, you know, being raised here and like me being raised, me and Amanda actually are both from Texas.
Right.
and being raised in a majority white, you know, space, mm-hmm. being the only, like, I was like one of like three Filipinos at my high school, which was like, my senior class was like 800 people. So,
wow.
It's what you just said. I was like, man, I wish I could feel that, you know?
It got me thinking about that too, because I was like, I think we do limit ourselves based on obviously our surroundings, and that's very, very dangerous. And I'm wondering if there's a way, you know, especially people that grow up here, is there a way to sort of combat that? Like, it's just really hard to think about. Even like for us getting into this business, getting into entertainment, it was, my parents weren't on board with it too. And part of it, the reason is there's not that many people that look like me that do this business. So it's, you know, we limit ourselves
and it's also that whole thing of we have to be excellent in order to succeed, and if we are anything below, then we, you know, it's like you lose your chance. It's like, which is like so heartbreaking to me, but I feel like we're seeing it change now.
Yeah.
This younger generation is like, they're not having it. Like, they're just like, we're gonna do what we want. We don't care what you say. It's just so interesting to hear you say that, because we wake up, like, I remember when we had Dawn Porter on for Good Trouble, she was saying that we wake up every day, or, you know, as a Black woman, she wakes up, you know, what Black tax, or what tax do I have to pay today? What do I have to fight today? What battle do I have to fight today? And to not have that, or like, just to like, you know, like for instance, like when I saw Raya on Disney, or, you know, that,
mm-hmm,
that and it's all Southeast Asian. And I was like, oh, wow, this is amazing. You know, seeing nuances of the Filipino culture, Thai culture. And I was like, is this how white people feel every time they see a movie?
Right. Well, that's exactly, you know, what you just said there before, Amanda, as well, in terms of how does one get that as someone growing up as a minority in a society? That's why I take so seriously this industry, because what you just said there is about Raya, that is one of the ways we feel seen, is when the culture around you shows that your perspective not only matters, but is allowed to be central. Because if you're one of three of what you are deemed to be in a class of 800, you feel like you are on the margins. You feel like you are peripheral. You do not feel central to that world. And if everything around you, culture-wise, politics, sport, whatever it is, if every facet of life is reaffirming that to you, it is almost impossible to fight through those perceptions that feel like realities because of what you're surrounded by. So that's why for me, in the work I do, I'm always looking for ways where people who look like me, my own personal perspective, is central to any narrative I'm putting out into the world, because I'm essentially speaking to my 12-year-old self, who, when he watched certain things, didn't feel central, but thankfully the environment I was in made me feel central. And so I understood that there is a conflict between how I feel and what I'm seeing. And so therefore, how do you put stuff out into the world that not only speaks to people who look like me, but speaks to people who don't, about the fact that they are not necessarily the center of the universe? There are other perspectives that are of value and that are informative and nourishing and enriching for them to pay attention to as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, look, speaking to that, you know, moving here stateside and seeing how this industry is and the bias and the unconscious bias, the blatant and subtle racism and microaggressions that the film and TV industry has, you know, were you aware, how did you manage your expectations when it came to kind of, I guess, transitioning over from the UK to here?
Yeah, it was definitely challenging because, you know, racism, marginalization, you know, having to fight your way through. I mean, what you said earlier about, you know, you have to be excellent to succeed. A lot of the time you have to be excellent just to survive.
Right.
Mm. You know, you're almost anomalous if you then go on to succeed. And so, you know, that was something I definitely felt. Not just in the industry, but in society in the UK. And then it's slightly different in America. The thing I like about America is that, you know, the racism in America will come at you head on. You know, like someone will just call you the N-word to your face. It'll just be like, oh, I see where we're going with this. In the UK, you know, you'll have had crumpets and tea with someone. You'll go home and then you'll put your hand on your back and you'll be like, why am I bleeding? And you'd be like, oh, that thing they said, was that?
Yeah.
You know what? Oh. You know, that's how racism works in the UK. It goes through this filter of politeness and class. Mm-hmm. And the class element is the real killer because everyone buys into it. Oh, I'm working class, I'm middle class, I'm upper class. And then you wear it as a badge of honor. But what it's actually doing is it's compartmentalizing people within that society and telling them do not deviate from that box. You know, class in America is different. It's about money. And at the end of the day, if you are making people money or if you are doing something or an individual who can bring about wealth, you can find a way through. And obviously that's not ideal, but there's a path.
Right.
Is I guess what I'm saying. So I would describe the American film industry as can do and the British film industry certainly historically as can don't. And, you know, I'd much rather be in can do, and the can do comes from FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. Everyone will meet you, everyone will consider you, but at the end of the day, the biases that exist within Hollywood mean that there is still this thing that also exists within the British system, which is that people are essentially hiring their friends, people who look like them, because they love themselves and they want to perpetuate them to the fact that they are important. And all I'm asking for in the work I do is that, okay, allow people who look like me and other people from all sorts of walks of life to be in positions of power so that they also can employ their biases. And by osmosis, we have more of a, you know, a representation of humanity. And so that I think is something that, as you guys said, is getting better. I think there have been these moments, these big moments, you know, one of which I was unexpectedly part of, you know, Oscar So White being mm-hmm. something that, you know, Selma, a film that I did playing Dr. King was one of the touch points for. And, you know, we've seen movements like Oscar So White or Me Too be opportunities to really hold not only our industry, but society accountable.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah,
hopefully. Yes. Good, I mean, answer.
I'm just hoping that, you know, I feel like sometimes in this industry, when you take one step forward, it's always two or three steps back. I mean, we saw what happened with the Golden Globes this year mm-hmm. after this whole Oscar So White movement. So, I mean, all you could do is sort of, you know, be optimistic and hopeful for the future, but I guess cautiously optimistic. Because
sometimes this industry makes it hard to be hopeful, right. but yeah.
Yeah, I would take it a step further. I'm not optimistic, and I'm not cautiously optimistic. I am determined to remain vigilant, because we have seen these moments in the past, whereby, you know, there's the Black Renaissance in the 90s, or there's, you know, they'll always take the opportunity to point at the one, you know, yeah. which is the exception, not the rule.
Right.
And the one way to normalize the marginalized, you know, being ever present and not on the fringes is for there to be a genuine redistribution of power. And that is about ownership. And I think that, you know, the shakeup that the pandemic has brought to the industry, what I'm hoping that content creators recognize is that they have more power than they realize. You know, without us, the studios will crater. To be perfectly frank, they're already doing that. And, you know, streamers have shown that, you know, history has shown empires fall. You know, the studios are in the process of they are about to become production companies for streamers. You know, that's literally what's about to happen.
That's true.
Yeah, it's on the,
there's this whole old way of thinking that a lot of, let's face it, a lot of old white cisgender hetero men, they have a grip on it, and they refuse to let it go, and kind of won't, you know, allow people to bring them to the present or even into the future.
And why should they, when everything you have grown up has seeing tells you you are top of the apex, you are important, you are the king, you are valuable, you are valued, you are desirable, everything in media, in politics, in everywhere you look.
Everything.
You on every poster, on every magazine, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. You are told it by the history you learn, by the way your looks are celebrated, that this is the way it is. So, you know, you can't blame them.
Yeah,
because there is a reason why in The Waterman, even though that script was originally written for a white family, there's a reason why I have very consciously and intentionally made it a Black family, because I loved those kind of films growing up, but I never saw myself represented in them. And I know that the younger equivalent of myself seeing a film like The Waterman, it shifts your perspective, because it's not about race. It's about a kid who loves his family and goes on an adventure and is at the center of the narrative. And if kids from all shades, from all places, get to see themselves represented in that way, you know, what you said earlier about must be nice to feel to feel the way you felt all the time, watching Raya, for them to feel that all the time must be nice. It is nice. It's great. It's fantastic.
Right.
That's why we need to do more of it for ourselves. So it's about ownership in order to be able to put that stuff out in the world.
Yes. And let's talk about The Waterman a little bit more. So is that why you decided to make this your first directorial? You wanted to direct this film, because this is your first time in the director's chair. This is Emma Nettles' script from, was it 2019 Blacklist?
2015
Blacklist. So it had all the elements that it seems like. Is that why you decided to choose it as your first? And then how long were you thinking about directing before you started this project?
Yeah, directing The Waterman came to me very, very much in a circuitous route. I'm a father of four kids. Like I said, I loved those kind of films growing up. Goonies, Stand By Me.
Yes, Goonies is my favorite.
No, yeah, just loved those from Gremlins. And they were smaller films, a lot of them made by Amblin, that, you know, had adventure, had a kid's perspective that was, you know, not patronizing the kids, but had both adventure, but a bit of meaning to it as well. I remember having great conversations with my parents after seeing those films. And I just, you know, as I became a parent and I didn't have those kind of films to share with my kids. I like watching Marvel movies with them, but to be perfectly honest, there's not much to sort of hold on to after you watch a Marvel movie. It's a bit like a roller coaster ride. You get off, you feel a little bit dizzy, and then you go about your day. But I like a movie that sort of sticks with me a little bit more. And so I said to my agency, you know, if there is a film like this out there, you know, I produce movies as well. I just love to make one of those films. And it coincided with The Waterman coming on the blacklist. I met with Emma Nidell, talked to her about my passion for these kind of films, talked to her about the fact that I'd love to play the father role and that would by osmosis make this a black family, and how she felt about that. She loved the idea. And so initially I was only going to produce it and be in it. We had a director. He left the project. And I had always wanted to direct. I'd always treated the wonderful acting jobs I had been getting as my film school, you know, watching directors and seeing how they do it. And, you know, Emma and my fellow producers, Oprah Winfrey and Carla Gardini, who runs her company, and Monica Levinson, they all knew I had this ambition to direct. And it was actually Emma who turned to me when we lost our director and said, I think you should do it, David. And I sort of took a moment to think about that, because I hadn't anticipated The Waterman being my directorial debut, but I realized just how passionate I was about seeing this story getting told, and how much I identified as Ghana, the young kid, as played by Lonnie Davis, in terms of the childlike side of myself, and how much I identified with Amos, the character I play, the father, you know, the very fallible but loving father that I play. And so there were just so many things about it that spoke to me, and so I decided to jump into the director's chair.
Who did you model the father after?
Ooh. Good question, because I wouldn't say he's me necessarily, okay. But where I do really identify with him personally is, you know, anyone who's a parent knows that it is an exercise in failure every day. I mean, you literally, it is impossible to continuously get that task right. But if you're coming from a place of love, there's a real chance that your children will be whole. Mm-hmm. Even if you're not getting it perfectly right. But, you know, I would say that he's for me, less based on any individual. He's more based on the fact that I wanted to show a family who was going through really tough issues, mm-hmm. where there were dysfunctional relationships, but love was central to the motivations for everyone within that family. Mm-hmm. Son to mother, mother to son, husband to wife, wife to husband, and parents towards their child, and vice versa. Right. Because no family is perfect, and you don't have to be perfect in order for love to be central to a family. And I wanted to make a film that any and every family can identify with. And those elements I talk about there, I see in every single family.
This episode is brought to you by Lifetime's Robin Roberts Presents Mahalia. From executive producers Robin Roberts and Linda Berman comes the biopic of the legendary Mahalia Jackson. Grammy Award winner Daniel Brooks stars as the trailblazer whose music moved, inspired, and changed people's hearts. Critics have praised Brooks's transformative performance into the Queen of Gospel as thunderingly good. Directed by Kenny Leon and written by Bettina Jilliwa and Todd Kreidler, this Lifetime original movie continues to inspire viewers and highlights the ongoing fight for social justice. Robin Roberts Presents Mahalia for your Emmy consideration in all categories.
Yeah, I love how I did feel that vibe of Goonies, Stand By Me, that Spielbergian era of like these films that I think a lot of us grew up with. And like thinking about it now, I'm like, oh, okay, Goonies. There was Goonies, there was, you know, Stand By Me. And then I was like, oh, there's never been any like literal color in them. Because like the first time I saw Goonies, I saw Dat Data, Kehu Kwan.
Yeah, yeah.
That was pretty much the first time I felt seen. Like I was all, wait a second, he's kind of like me, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, all these white kids are hanging out with this Asian, this like smart Asian kid.
Right.
And like, we have stuff like, we're seeing kind of it evolve with like Stranger Things, you know?
Yes.
But to see it in Waterman and have see this kid who I actually related to, like I was just like, oh he drew comics, he has this like wild imagination. And I was like, that was so me, you know? And just like even that kind of was just like, you know, again, representation matters. And I know we say that a lot, but it's true.
It just does.
Yeah.
It just does.
You have to keep saying it, to be honest. I think, you know, we do get tired and it becomes a buzzword, but it's like, it's true. And people need to be reminded.
It's so true.
Yeah, you need to keep saying it, and we need to keep seeing it as well, you know, and for me, it's not just about Black and brown kids seeing themselves in a character like Gunna. What's as important is white kids seeing themselves in a kid like
Gunna.
Because I think that's where empathy can come into a society, when you can see yourself in people who don't necessarily look like you, who aren't from the same place as you're from. That's the thing that breaks down prejudice, because prejudice is rooted in fear of the unknown. Oh, you don't look like me, you're not from where I'm from. We must be so different that maybe we're enemies, maybe we're at odds. And then worse still, if you have parents or a society that then validates that way of thinking, it just exacerbates it. But you know, so often, films are the way that we feel seen and we see other cultures, other people. You know, I've been identifying with white people my entire life just because that's what I see all the time. And then when we tell our stories, a lot of the time, one of the challenges you face is feeling like you need to give all of this backstory and then explain why there's a Black family in Oregon. And like, No, I'm not explaining any of that. They're just in this place and they're doing human being things in a human being way, in a fantastical journey. Come along for the ride. I'm just so tired of explaining or apologizing for my existence. I'm just not gonna do it.
Yeah,
here.
I think that's the thing is like, we've been raised in this culture where the white protagonist has been the default. Right. It's like, we know that story. We know, like, again, going back to Stand By Me, I so related to Vern, the chubby kid now it's kind of y'all's turn to relate to us.
I agree. I was watching Daniel Kaluuya on SNL, I think a couple weeks back, and they did this sketch, him and Edo, is that her name? Edo? I can't remember the Black, she's Nigerian. She's on SNL. Okay. But like, they did a sketch about like Nigerian parents and like how they, like, it was a Nigerian parent family and a white family. And they were talking about their kids going into the arts.
Right.
And like, Daniel and her name is, I think it's Edo, but watching them, I was dying because I understood exactly what they were talking about. But in my back of my head, I was like, are white people gonna get this? Like, I don't know why I was just so concerned, but it's like, I never have to, like you said, we've all identified with white people our whole lives. Like, we get their jokes too, you know? Like, so
now it's time for them to get ours, right?
It was so refreshing seeing like these two people like making these jokes on such a mainstream show. Like it lit me. I was so happy. I was dying of laughter. It just feels really good to see stuff like that, you know? And hopefully we see more of that.
Well, that's what I loved about Minari as well. You mentioned that already. And that, again, it didn't apologize for, you know, the language, the culture, the American dream, the specificity of it, the cultural specificity of it, you know? And for me personally, it is very, very clear to me that the universal is found in the specific. The more specific you make it, actually, the more people identify with it, because you find yourself going, oh my gosh, my family's weird too.
Yeah.
Your family's weird. Oh my God, you know what I mean? The quirkier, right. The weirder, I mean, life is so much stranger than fiction. And I think just to unapologetically tell your truth in your storytelling is the key.
Yes,
I agree. And I think, yeah, and it's like with Yeo-jung, Yeon, who plays the grandmother in Minari, so many people were like, oh, that's my grandmother. No exactly. matter Asian, Black, Latino, white, they're just like, oh, that's, and she didn't even speak English in the right. in the movie.
Yeah.
And that speaks so much. And like, I am ready for her to get her Oscar on April 20th, because I bawled in that movie. But but David, I want to ask you, like, this, the Waterman has a lot to do with kind of folklore and urban legends. Are you a believer, or is there like a folklore or urban legend from your childhood that you kind of tapped into when you were directing this?
Well, gosh, you know, growing up in Nigeria, we are all about that. You know, I mean, like, there were urban legends, there were myths, there were stories, there are family stories, there are, you know, and there are ceremonies, there are these masquerades who will be dancing in the street, and they go around whipping you if you've been naughty.
Yeah.
there are, you know, you'd read in the newspaper about, you know, this witch doctor had given someone a potion because this man was having an affair with a woman, and then he got stuck inside her. And this is like literally in like the New York Times.
Yeah.
Our equivalent. You know, so I grew up in a culture whereby all of that was just really present.
Yeah.
And as a kid, you combine that with a kid's imagination, you are believing everything.
Yeah.
You know, and so it really makes for a colorful, rich tapestry to live your life within. And so, you know, when you're in the dark, there is no way someone is telling you there isn't a dinosaur coming for you, because you just have all this imagery in your head of like, I saw it, but, you know. And so for me, the Waterman was very much about that close relationship between reality and fantasy as it pertains to a child's existence. Mm-hmm. And when you then combine some of the tougher things in life, when your imagination is all over the place, it explodes. You know, and that's why we do a lot of juxtaposing the reality as parents and grownups see it and the reality as a kid sees it. So, you know, without giving too many spoilers, there are things that Gunnar sees in the forest and then get explained as something completely different than what he saw, but they were real for him, and they're right. completely real for someone else. And that is very much the child, you know, that's one of the gifts of being a child. And it's one of the things we lose as we get older is, you know, there is something to be said for having a wide-eyed, imaginative perspective when you're dealing with trauma, when you're dealing with pain. We lose so much of that as we get older. And that's why, you know, there's that example, you know, babies, when they fall over, they don't break bones because they just go with it. When you're older, you start to get really rigid and you fall in the same way, you break bones. It's because, you know too much as you get older. And that's, you know, Gunnar is at this tender age. It's a rites of passage movie. So he's at 11 and he's just going from that place where imagination is everything and reality is just waiting around the corner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I appreciated about the movie, because, again, no spoilers, but, you know, there's, you know, kind of a moment where I'm just like, oh, I know that in this situation, as an adult, I would be all, this is kind of silly.
Right.
But then you're
right,
just like,
right.
But then you're just like, oh, why not just embrace it? You know, it's like, I think, especially in the film industry, when it comes to storytelling or film and TV, when people are like, oh, that's silly, or that will never happen. And I'm like, right. Oh, you'll say that about kind of this indie movie, but you won't say anything about this Marvel movie, which is all about, you know, make-believe.
Yeah.
I love how you said that. It's kind of like, lighten up in this interesting way. It's like, don't be so, like, you know, judgy and be all, this is a fantasy, go with
it. E.T. is the perfect example to me. When you think back to E.T., you know, that film starts with a family where the father has just left The mother is looking down the barrel of being a single parent, and these kids are like, where's dad? Who's this lady he's gone off to be with? Like real, like really intense family issues. And then that same night, they find an alien in the shed.
Right.
What the heck? Do you know what I mean? But there is something about it. It's allegorical of the fact that you can be dealing with the realest of the real one moment, and then you look up and it's like, whoa, what's happening over there? And that's the joy of being a kid.
Yeah.
You know, and that's also the joy of storytelling. That you can use something like The Waterman and like adventure and like fantasy to really bring closer the reality of situations we face every day.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So this movie comes out May 7th.
Yeah.
Correct? Yes.
Yeah,
okay, so what is next for you, David? What can you tell us? Are you doing more directing projects? I know you've said you're filming something right now.
Yeah, it's been beautifully busy. As you say, The Waterman comes out May 7th. It's in theaters, which is wonderful because, you know, we made the film before the pandemic. We had to do the post during the pandemic, which is really, really tough. But, you know, we're prayerful that people will see it in the environment it was designed to be seen before it then goes on to VOD eventually. So that I couldn't be more excited about if I tried. But yeah, you know, I have Peter Rabbit 2 coming out soon after that in June. I loved doing that film. I loved the first one. And actually working with Will Gluck was amazing because I worked with him just before I went on to direct The Waterman. And that was really instructive for me. You know, I also, during the pandemic, I shot a film called Solitary with Nate Parker. And that one's about a guy who has been in solitary confinement for 7 years and then comes out and is trying to rebuild his life with his son and fiance and is really struggling to discern what is real and what is imagined, because that solitary confinement really messes with your head, your mental state. And that's a film I'm really, really proud of. I also produced it along with Nate and Aaron Gilbert and the guys at Bronze Studios. And then I did this murder mystery film. It's untitled at the moment for Fox Searchlight. Oh, it's Searchlight now, not even Fox Searchlight.
Yes. And
I play a flamboyant playwright in the 50s in that one. I loved doing that.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see that one.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And great cast. Saoirse Ronan, Sam Rockwell, you know, I mean, just Adrian Brody, Ruth Wilson. Just,
oh, my God. That's a cast. That's a cast.
Yeah,
it's really great. And I'm here in Bristol doing a limited series for HBO and the BBC with Gugu Mbatha-Raw right now. And that's
love her.
Yeah, amazing.
Went to school together? Are you and Gugu? Are you guys?
We were born in the same hospital in Oxford.
What?
You know, quite a few years apart. Well, yeah, you know, a couple years apart. You know, obviously coming up in the British scene, I've known Gugu for about 10 years. We did a film called Cloverfield Paradox together. Yeah. A film I produced and was also in called Come Away. She was in. Yeah. And she actually was even in a film that my wife directed, a short film called After the Storm, and she played my middle son's mother in that film. I know her really well.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing all of those. And did you say you're going to direct more? Or
I want to. I really, really want to. But, you know, I have this wonderful day job of being an actor, which I really love doing. And when you direct, you know, it better be something you love, because you're going to watch that film hundreds of times. And I mean, literally. and also it takes about a year and a half, 2 years of your life. And that's a lot of movies for me that means I can't do. So I'm waiting for that thing that really makes it worth paying that price. But I loved the experience of directing and I just love storytelling, and I really admire actors like George Clooney, like Nate Parker, like Joel Edgerton, like Mel Gibson, who, you know, like Regina Regina King, who are directing as well as acting, Clint Eastwood being the big daddy of all of those guys. I just love the idea of having a career where I can continue to do that.
Yeah. You mentioned George Clooney. I was going to say, I love that, the Midnight Sky movie. Oh my gosh.
Thank you.
So, yeah, it was so good. So we like to wrap up our interview with a segment we call the Facts or the FAQs, just a fun random question segment, a fun way to wrap up the session. So your first question is, what was your favorite toy as a child?
Oh, I had an Action Man, a G.I. Joe thing. Mm. That was my favorite. And, you know, I could never get my hair to be bristly like him. See how they do us? There was never a black one. So I was constantly going, why doesn't my hair do that thing? I had the same thing with the Fonz in Happy Days. I was like, why doesn't the Fonz do my hair, you know, the way it does for Henry Winkler? Yeah, they do us. We've got to change this.
Exactly. You know? Representation matters. We're going to keep saying
yes.
it.
Okay, so what was the last movie you saw in a movie theater?
Oh, gosh. The last movie I saw in a
theater with an audience, mind you.
I honestly don't even remember mine.
How depressing is this that I don't even know? It can't be. What's that? Why am I blanking on the name? The Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga film.
A Star is Born.
Can't be A Star is Born.
No, it can be.
I remember. It was Sonic the Hedgehog. It was Sonic the Hedgehog.
That makes sense.
That was like right when.
Just before our lives.
Yeah. I just watched that movie.
Amanda, you don't remember yours?
I have no idea. I don't. I might not. Cause when did the lockdown happen? April, right?
Okay.
I had to have
March. It was because I remember March. It was March 13th March. Here in LA.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Mine was Mulan, which was the premiere.
Oh yeah, I remember. Even
to
the premiere, right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I remember the after party. People were like people were already getting a little bit like.
Oh really?
And like, yeah, like right. they were serving us. We couldn't serve ourselves. And I remember one of my friends took a cookie off a tray, and they were like, "Oh, now we're gonna have to throw that whole tray out because you."
Wow.
you That's gonna be us soon.
Telling me that. Okay. Okay. What is the funnest way you have ever broken the law? The funniest way. Yeah, the funniest.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, I'm such a good boy. Oh my goodness. The funniest way I've ever, you know what? It's literally, can I say, am I gonna get arrested if I admit this?
Like, no, this is a safe space. Funniest way. I mean,
yeah,
we'll share ours
way.
Too.
Funniest way, I probably ran a red light or two when I, you know.
Oh my God, David, we're gonna.
When I got my new Tesla, but it was a Tesla, you guys. It was a Tesla. You cannot get a new Tesla and be thinking about the lights. You know, and it was just the first time I drove it. Honestly, officer, you can't come to me now. It was a new Tesla.
Wait, Amanda, do you have one?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of ways that I have broken the law. And trying to see which one would be the funniest.
You're really like this, guys. So you made me like confess a thing, and now you're gonna say, you know what? I will admit
that I have broken the law a couple of times. I know that for sure. I'm just trying to think of the funniest one, but I can't think of one.
Well, there has been multiple times when I have gone to the grocery store or a Target and realize I opened the bag and I'm all, wait, did I pay for this? Look at the receipt and I didn't. Does that count? That's kind of like shoplifting adjacent.
That's unintentional though. You didn't intentionally take an item. Maybe they forgot.
I can tell it's burning on your conscience, and that's how you know you should have taken it back. You did wrong. I think you should go back to that store like now. Right. Get on a mask and go and pay.
Go to
return that item.
I accidentally put this face mask on. It was like, it was kind of one of those gel face masks.
I have so much Christian guilt about the red light right now.
I've definitely intentionally run red lights before, especially at night.
No, me too.
Take forever. And I'm
when there's no one there.
Yeah, when there's no one there, I'll run. I've run lights.
Yeah, before. I should make and that clarification. Like, I should make that clarification. There's no one there. Ventura is very quiet at night sometimes. And you know, come on, guys.
You know, do you do the thing when you're like, when you're driving and you see it turning yellow, but you kind of just avoid seeing it turn red and you're just like, oh, I'm fine. Like,
That's only you. Yeah. That's only that you. You should feel terrible.
He's like closing his eyes. I can do it.
I'm just like, oh, it's yellow. But yeah, that's me.
Well, this is your own internal monologue we're hearing right now. It's really interesting.
I'm total trash. I steal face masks from Target and I run red lights.
Dino, go ask for your do your Hail Marys
I wanna pray. I mean, I'm like hello Filipino Christian or Catholic guilt. Like it's like mourning the religion rather than celebrating. It's like so I feel guilty. Like hardcore, like Filipino. Man. Like I remember there were days when my mom would be all, "Y'all get down here. We're gonna pray the rosary for an hour," and I'll be all, "Oh God, I have homework." And she's like, "I don't care." She's like, "I don't care. You're here." Okay. So our next question. Okay, here, another hypothetical. You are stranded on a deserted island, and you have everything you need to survive. You have a nice house, entertainment, medical care, clothes, running water, reliable electricity, everything. The only thing is, you have to choose one chain restaurant to provide your food for the rest of your life. What would it be?
Spago.
Oh, really?
Oh, what? That's fancy.
Of course
it's fancy. I'm snobbish. Didn't you watch the BAFTAs last night? What did you think I was going to say? In and out?
Yeah, well, there you go.
That's what I would say.
No.
You're
going to
say In and Out.
No, I wouldn't say In and Out.
You guys need to listen to Ya Jung Yun. This is like the thing, right? I am snobbish.
Okay, no,
Spago on tap. Thank you.
That's good. That's good.
On tap. I like that.
That's good. I actually like that. You were honest, and I appreciate it. I would actually choose Cheesecake Factory.
If we're choosing fancy restaurants, I would choose Ocean Prime, even though like kind of like in the middle, but Ocean Prime has really good lobster and steak. Just
oh, there you go.
I guess I'm the only like trash. I'm the trash here. I'm all, I want Cheesecake Factory.
That bread, I could live off of that brown bread though.
Yeah.
Same here.
Okay. And plus the Cheesecake Factory menu is like a yearbook. It is.
They have a lot. Okay. Would you rather never have to clean a bathroom again or never have to do the dishes again?
Ooh. Never have to do the dishes again. I think the dishes, you know, like when you have a dried up egg whisk to deal with, or you know, someone's, you know, done oatmeal and just left it there. That's quite different than a tub.
Very annoying. Yeah.
It's very, very annoying. They're more multifaceted, I think, dishes than a bathroom.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that because there is something satisfying about, you know, after like crossing your arms and looking at a clean bathroom after you did, there's like something very satisfying about that.
Not for Amanda.
Not to you.
I hate cleaning toilets. That's the one thing I would.
Right.
If I didn't have to clean the toilets, then I would say bath or dishes, but I can't. I hate cleaning toilets.
Really?
Oh, well.
Yeah. I'm so sorry.
So now
I can't help you there. I can't help you there, Amanda. It's just a fact of life.
Yeah,
it's gotta be
done. Right. I mean, hopefully.
Yeah, we're learning
like cleaning toilets one day. Like, shoot, maybe I should.
It's difficult. We're learning a lot
These
about-
These are very first world problems, Duga.
Right, right.
Let's just clarify this. You saying it's difficult? I felt we were going down a road where we would be like, these people need to go and live some life.
Right. Go back to live in the village.
They need to go back to also, village somewhere.
They'll show you how to clean a bathroom. Also, we- bathroom looks like,
oh. Oh, God.
You're right, let me take God, that
we're
back.
We're like- Back we're learning a lot about each other here, and I don't know if it's good or bad,
but
okay. So David, our last question is there an underrepresented voice in the industry, whether it's an actor, writer, or producer, creator, that is not mainstream or doesn't have enough shine on them that you think people need to know about and you want to give a shout out to? Multiple answers are accepted.
Ooh.
Feel free. Yeah.
Wow. There's Amel Amin is an actor who I just think is so powerful, so talented, multi-talented. That guy, to me, he should be up there with the John Boyegas and the Daniel Kaluuyas. You know, he is someone I just think is a fantastic talent. I'm cheating here because he is well known, and I wouldn't say he's mainstream, but I just think Jeffrey Wright is one of the best living.
No, actors, you're right.
You know, and I just, for me, I don't know. He's look, I'm sure he feels he's doing fine. I just can't get enough of Jeffrey Wright.
No,
you know?
I agree. Yeah.
He is a stupendous talent.
And I love him on Twitter too. Yeah,
Oh, well, I'm not on Twitter. I didn't know he has a whole Twitter thing.
Yeah, he has a opinion, and he is not afraid to say it, and I love it.
Yeah. I totally agree. It's like he's been around. Like, he's been doing amazing things from the beginning of his career. Like, when I saw him in Angels in America, that performance. Oh,
I mean, like, Basquiat. And he doesn't know how to give a bad performance. It is ridiculous how talented he is.
Yeah. And just like his versatility, is like seeing him in Hunger Games and him just like turning around and doing something like, you know, Westworld. It's just like, what is this man? Where did he come from? And why aren't we not loving him more? That kind of
thing. Yeah. I think he's brilliant. But Amel, I think, is a special talent.
Yeah, I think we'll see more of Amel soon. I know he's directing something, so I think we're going to see.
He's directed a film called Boxing Day. So looking forward to that.
David, thank you.
Oh, sorry, Amanda, I was interrupting.
No, it's okay. I was just saying thank you for being here. This was an amazing conversation. I'm very happy to have you on. And congrats to your completing your first film. And I hope that we get to see some more from you in the future.
Thank you. Well, this has been so much more fun than I should be able to have at like 10:30 at night in the UK.
And thank you for staying up late for us for our little podcast.
No. This was so much fun. And we covered everything. So we solved the world. I can now sleep well.
We solved
all of it.
And we admitted to breaking the law. Well, I did more than anyone else.
You are a full-on criminal after this. You're stealing masks. You're food.
Running red lights.
Running red lights. And you didn't say enough Hail Marys. You are a mess.
My mom is going to call me after this episode airs. And I'm like, oh, you need to come home now. Get out of LA. You're coming home living with us.
Everyone else would get cleansed. You need to be exorcised.
Yes. Target, I am sorry. I'm gonna go back to Target. David Oyelowo told me to return this mask that I took.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, thank you again so much. This has been so fun. Like, I'm actually
sweating. It's fun. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you, you guys. We'll speak soon.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.